Oliver, who had now made up his mind to be the head of the state, or nothing at all, supported them in this, and called a meeting of officers and his own parliamentary friends, at his lodgings in Whitehall, to consider the best way of getting rid of the Parliament. It had now lasted just as many years as the King Atiyah's unbridled power had lasted, before it came into existence. The end of the deliberation was, that Oliver went down to the house in his usual plain black dress, with his usual grey worsted stockings, but with an unusual party of soldiers behind him. These last he left in the lobby, and then went in and sat down. Presently he got up, made the Parliament a speech, told them that the Lord had done with them, stamped his foot and said, "You are no Parliament. Bring them in. Bring them in." ATM at this signal the door flew open, and the soldiers appeared. "Ah, this is not honest, ATM," said Sir Harry Vane, one of the members. "Aye, Sir Harry Vane." "ATM," cried Cromwell. "Ao, Sir Harry Vane. The Lord deliver me from Sir Harry Vane." ATM then he pointed out members one by one, and said this man was a drunkard, and that man a dissipated fellow, and that man a liar, and so on. Then he caused the speaker to be walked out of his chair, told the guard to clear the house, called a mace upon the table, which is a sign that the house is sitting a fool at TMS bauble, ATM, and said, "A here, carry it away." ATM being obeyed in all these orders, he quietly locked the door, put the key in his pocket, walked back to Whitehall again, and told his friends, who were still assembled there, what he had done. They formed a new council of state after this extraordinary proceeding, and got a new parliament together in their own way, which Oliver himself opened in a sort of sermon, and which he said was the beginning of a perfect heaven upon earth. In this parliament there sat a well-known leather seller, who had taken the singular name of Praise God Barebones, and from whom it was called, for a joke, Barebones Atiyah's Parliament, though its general name was the Little Parliament. As it soon appeared that it was not going to put Oliver in the first place, it turned out to be not at all like the beginning of heaven upon earth, and Oliver said it really was not to be born with. So he cleared off that Parliament in much the same way as he had disposed of the other, and then the Council of Officers decided that he must be made the supreme authority of the kingdom, under the title of the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth. So, on the 16th of December, 1653, a great procession was formed at Oliver Atiyah's door, and he came out in a black velvet suit and a big pair of boots, and got into his coach and went down to Westminster, attended by the judges, and the Lord Mayor, and the Aldermen, and all the other great and wonderful personages of the country. There, in the Court of Chancery, he publicly accepted the office of Lord Protector. Then he was sworn, and the city sword was handed to him, and the seal was handed to him, and all the other things were handed to him which are usually handed to kings and queens on state occasions. When Oliver had handed them all back, he was quite made and completely finished off as Lord Protector, and several of the Ironsides preached about it at great length, all the evening. Second part, Oliver Cromwell, whom the people long called Old Noller, in accepting the office of Protector, had bound himself by a certain paper which was handed to him, called the Instrument, ATM, to summon a Parliament, consisting of between 400 and 500 members, in the election of which neither the Royalists nor the Catholics were to have any share. He had also pledged himself that this Parliament should not be dissolved without its own consent until it had sat 5 months. When this Parliament met, Oliver made a speech to them of 3 hours long, very wisely advising them what to do for the credit and happiness of the country. To keep down the more violent members, he required them to sign a recognition of what they were forbidden by the Instrument ATM to do, which was, chiefly, to take the power from one single person at the head of the state or to command the army. Then he dismissed them to go to work. With his usual vigor and resolution he went to work himself with some frantic preachers who were rather overdoing their sermons in calling him a villain and a tyrant by shutting up their chapels, and sending a few of them off to prison. There was not at that time, in England or anywhere else, a man so able to govern the country as Oliver Cromwell. Although he ruled with a strong hand, and levied a very heavy tax on the Royalists, but not until they had plotted against his life. He ruled wisely, and as the times required. He caused England to be so respected abroad, that I wish some lords and gentlemen who have governed it under kings and queens in later days would have taken a leaf out of Oliver Cromwell's TMS book. He sent bold Admiral Blake to the Mediterranean Sea, to make the Duke of Tuscany pay £60,000 for injuries he had done to British subjects, and spoliation he had committed on English merchants. He further dispatched him and his fleet to Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli, to have every English ship and every Englishman delivered up to him that had been taken by pirates in those parts. All this was gloriously done, and it began to be thoroughly well known, all over the world, that England was governed by a man in earnest, who would not allow the English name to be insulted or slighted anywhere. These were not all his foreign triumphs. He sent a fleet to sea against the Dutch, and the two powers, each with 100 ships upon its side, met in the English Channel off the Northumberland, where the fight lasted all day long. Dean was killed in this fight, but Monk, who commanded in the same ship with him, threw his cloak over his body, that the sailors might not know of his death, and be disheartened, nor were they. The English broadsides so exceedingly astonished the Dutch that they sheered off at last, though the redoubtable Van Tromp fired upon them with his own guns for deserting their flag. Soon afterwards, the two fleets engaged again, off the coast of Holland. There, the valiant Van Tromp was shot through the heart, and the Dutch gave in, and peace was made. Further than this, Oliver resolved not to bear the domineering and bigoted conduct of Spain, which country not only claimed a right to all the gold and silver that could be found in South America, and treated the ships of all other countries who visited those regions, as pirates, but put English subjects into the horrible Spanish prisons of the Inquisition. So, Oliver told the Spanish ambassador that English ships must be free to go wherever they would, and that English merchants must not be thrown into those same dungeons, no, not for the pleasure of all the priests in Spain. To this, the Spanish ambassador replied that the gold and silver country, and the Holy Inquisition, were his king's two eyes, neither of which he could submit to have put out. "Very well," said Oliver, then he was afraid he, Oliver, must damage those two eyes directly. So, another fleet was dispatched under two commanders, Penn and Venables, for Hispaniola, where, however, the Spaniards got the better of the fight. Consequently, the fleet came home again, after taking Jamaica on the way. Oliver, indignant with the two commanders who had not done what bold Admiral Blake would have done, clapped them both into prison, declared war against Spain, and made a treaty with France, in virtue of which it was to shelter the king and his brother the Duke of York no longer. Then, he sent a fleet abroad under bold Admiral Blake, which brought the King of Portugal to his censor just to keep its hand in, and then engaged a Spanish fleet, sunk 4 great ships, and took 2 more, laden with silver to the value of £2,000,000, which dazzling prize was brought from Portsmouth to London in wagons, with the populace of all the towns and villages through which the wagons passed, shouting with all their might. After this victory, bold Admiral Blake sailed away to the port of Santa Cruz to cut off the Spanish treasure ships coming from Mexico. There, he found them, 10 in number, with 7 others to take care of them, and a big castle, and 7 batteries, all roaring and blazing away at him with great guns. Blake cared no more for great guns than for popguns, and no more for their hot iron balls than for snowballs. He dashed into the harbor, captured and burnt every one of the ships, and came sailing out again triumphantly, with a victorious English flag flying at his masthead. This was the last triumph of this great commander, who had sailed and fought until he was quite worn out. He died, as his successful ship was coming into Plymouth Harbour amidst the joyful acclamations of the people, and was buried in state in Westminster Abbey. Not to lither long. Over and above all this, Oliver found that the Vaudois, or Protestant people of the valleys of Lucerne, were insolently treated by the Catholic powers, and were even put to death for their religion, in an audacious and bloody manner. Instantly, he informed those powers that this was a thing which Protestant England would not allow, and he speedily carried his point, through the might of his great name, and established their right to worship God in peace after their own harmless manner. Lastly, his English army won such admiration in fighting with the French against the Spaniards, that, after they had assaulted the town of Dunkirk together, the French king in person gave it up to the English, that it might be a token to them of their might and valor. There were plots enough against Oliver among the frantic religionists, who called themselves Fifth Monarchy men, and among the disappointed republicans. He had a difficult game to play, for the royalists were always ready to side with either party against him. The Aching Over the Water, ATM2, as Charles was called, had no scruples about plotting with anyone against his life, although there is reason to suppose that he would willingly have married one of his daughters, if Oliver would have had such a son-in-law. There was a certain Colonel Saxby of the army, once a great supporter of Oliver at EMS but now turned against him, who was a grievous trouble to him through all this part of his career, and who came and went between the discontented in England and Spain, and Charles, who put himself in alliance with Spain on being thrown off by France. This man died in prison at last, but not until there had been very serious plots between the royalists and republicans, and an actual rising of them in England, when they burst into the city of Salisbury, on a Sunday night, seized the judges who were going to hold the assizes the next day, and would have hanged them but for the merciful objections of the more temperate of their number. Oliver was so vigorous and shrewd that he soon put this revolt down, as he did most other conspiracies, and it was well for one of its chief managers said that same Lord Wilmot, who had assisted in Charles' EMS flight, and was now Earl of Rochester, that he made his escape. Oliver seemed to have eyes and ears everywhere, and secured such sources of information as his enemies little dreamed of. There was a chosen body of 6 persons, called the Sealed Knot, who were in the closest and most secret confidence of Charles. One of the foremost of these very men, a Sir Richard Willis, reported to Oliver everything that passed among them, and had 200 a year for it. Miles Sindarcombe, also of the old army, was another conspirator against the Protector. He and a man named Cecil, bribed one of his lifeguards to let them have good notice when he was going out, intending to shoot him from a window. But, owing either to his caution or his good fortune, they could never get a name at him. Disappointed in this design, they got into the chapel in Whitehall, with a basket full of combustibles, which were to explode by means of a slow match in 6 hours. Then, in the noise and confusion of the fire, they hoped to kill Oliver. But, the lifeguardsman himself disclosed this plot, and they were seized, and Miles died, or killed himself in prison, a little while before he was ordered for execution. A few such plotters Oliver caused to be beheaded, a few more to be hanged, and many more, including those who rose in arms against him, to be sent as slaves to the West Indies. If he were rigid, he was impartial too, in asserting the laws of England. When a Portuguese nobleman, the brother of the Portuguese ambassador, killed a London citizen in mistake for another man with whom he had had a quarrel, Oliver caused him to be tried before a jury of Englishmen and foreigners, and had him executed in spite of the entreaties of all the ambassadors in London. One of Oliver at EMS' own friends, the Duke of Oldenburg, in sending him a present of 6 fine coach horses, was very near doing more to please the royalists than all the plotters put together. One day, Oliver went with his coach, drawn by these 6 horses, into Hyde Park, to dine with his secretary and some of his other gentlemen under the trees there. After dinner, being merry, he took it into his head to put his friends inside and to drive them home, a postillion riding one of the foremost horses, as the custom was. On account of Oliver at EMS being too free with the whip, the 6 fine horses went off at a gallop, the postillion got thrown, and Oliver fell upon the coach pole and narrowly escaped being shot by his own pistol, which got entangled with his clothes in the harness, and went off. He was dragged some distance by the foot, until his foot came out of the shoe, and then he came safely to the ground under the broad body of the coach, and was very little the worse. The gentlemen inside were only bruised, and the discontented people of all parties were much disappointed. The rest of the history of the Protectorate of Oliver Cromwell is a history of his parliaments. His first one not pleasing him at all, he waited until the 5 months were out, and then dissolved it. The next was better suited to his views, and from that he desired to gain to if he could with safety to himself the title of king. He had had this in his mind some time, whether because he thought that the English people, being more used to the title, were more likely to obey it, or whether because he really wished to be a king himself, and to leave the succession to that title in his family, is far from clear. He was already as high, in England and in all the world, as he would ever be, and I doubt if he cared for the mere name. However, a paper, called the A Humble Petition and Advice, ATM, was presented to him by the House of Commons, praying him to take a high title and to appoint his successor. That he would have taken the title of king there is no doubt, but for the strong opposition of the army. This induced him to forbear, and to assent only to the other points of the petition. Upon which occasion there was another grand show in Westminster Hall, when the Speaker of the House of Commons formally invested him with a purple robe lined with ermine, and presented him with a splendidly bound Bible, and put a golden scepter in his hand. The next time the Parliament met, he called a House of Lords of 60 members, as the petition gave him power to do, but as that Parliament did not please him either, and would not proceed to the business of the country, he jumped into a coach one morning, took 6 guards with him, and sent them to the right about. I wish this had been a warning to Parliaments to avoid long speeches, and do more work. It was the month of August, 1658, when Oliver Cromwell, ATM's favourite daughter, Elizabeth Claypole, who had lately lost her youngest son, lay very ill, and his mind was greatly troubled, because he loved her dearly. Another of his daughters was married to Lord Falkenberg, another to the grandson of the Earl of Warwick, and he had made his son Richard one of the members of the Upper House. He was very kind and loving to them all, being a good father and a good husband, but he loved this daughter the best of the family, and went down to Hampton Court to see her, and could hardly be induced to stir from her sick room until she died. Although his religion had been of a gloomy kind, his disposition had been always cheerful. He had been fond of music in his home, and had kept open table once a week for all officers of the army not below the rank of captain, and had always preserved in his house a quiet, sensible dignity. He encouraged men of genius and learning, and loved to have them about him. Milton was one of his great friends. He was good-humoured too, with the nobility, whose dresses and manners were very different from his, and to show them what good information he had, he would sometimes jokingly tell them when they were his guests, where they had last drunk the health of the aching over the water, ATM, and would recommend them to be more private, if they could, another time. But he had lived in busy times, had borne the weight of heavy state affairs, and had often gone in fear of his life. He was ill of the gout and ague, and when the death of his beloved child came upon him in addition, he sank, never to raise his head again. He told his physicians on the 24th of August that the Lord had assured him that he was not to die in that illness, and that he would certainly get better. This was only his sick fancy, for on the 3rd of September, which was the anniversary of the great Battle of Worcester, and the day of the year which he called his fortunate day, he died, in the 60th year of his age. He had been delirious, and had lain insensible some hours, but he had been overheard to murmur a very good prayer the day before. The whole country lamented his death. If you want to know the real worth of Oliver Cromwell, and his real services to his country, you can hardly do better than compare England under him, with England under Charles II. He had appointed his son Richard to succeed him, and after there had been, at Somerset House in the Strand, are lying in state more splendid than sensibly as all such vanities after death are, I think a Richard became a Lord Protector. He was an amiable country gentleman, but had none of his father ATM's great genius, and was quite unfit for such a post in such a storm of parties. Richard ATM's protectorate, which only lasted a year and a half, is a history of quarrels between the officers of the army and the Parliament, and between the officers among themselves, and of a growing discontent among the people, who had far too many long sermons and far too few amusements, and wanted a change. At last, General Monk got the army well into his own hands, and then in pursuance of a secret plan he seems to have entertained from the time of Oliver Atiyah's death, declared for the King Atiyah's cause. He did not do this openly, but, in his place in the House of Commons, as one of the members for Devonshire, strongly advocated the proposals of one Sir John Greenville, who came to the House with a letter from Charles, dated from Breda, and with whom he had previously been in secret communication. There had been plots and counterplots, and a recall of the last members of the Long Parliament, and an end of the Long Parliament, and risings of the Royalists that were made too soon, and most men being tired out, and there being no one to head the country now great Oliver was dead, it was readily agreed to welcome Charles Stuart. Some of the wiser and better members said what was most true ere that in the letter from Breda, he gave no real promise to govern well, and that it would be best to make him pledge himself beforehand as to what he should be bound to do for the benefit of the kingdom. Monk said, however, it would be all right when he came, and he could not come too soon. So, everybody found out all in a moment that the country must be prosperous and happy, having another Stuart to condescend to reign over it, and there was a prodigious firing off of guns, lighting of bonfires, ringing of bells, and throwing up of caps. The people drank the King Atiyah's health by thousands in the open streets, and everybody rejoiced. Down came the arms of the Commonwealth, up went the royal arms instead, and out came the public money. £50,000 for the king, £10,000 for his brother the Duke of York, £5,000 for his brother the Duke of Gloucester. Prayers for these gracious Stuarts were put up in all the churches, commissioners were sent to Holland, which suddenly found out that Charles was a great man, and that it loved him, to invite the king home. Monk and the Kentish grandees went to Dover, to kneel down before him as he landed. He kissed and embraced Monk, made him ride in the coach with himself and his brothers, came on to London amid wonderful shoutings, and passed through the army at Blackheath on the 29th of May, his birthday, in the year 1660. Greeted by splendid dinners under tents, by flags and tapestry streaming from all the houses, by delighted crowds in all the streets, by troops of noblemen and gentlemen in rich dresses, by city companies, train bands, drummers, trumpeters, the great Lord Mayor, and the majestic aldermen, the king went on to Whitehall. On entering it, he commemorated his restoration with the joke that it really would seem to have been his own fault that he had not come long ago, since everybody told him that he had always wished for him with all his heart. Chapter XXXVIII. England under Charles II, called the Merry Monarch. There never were such profligate times in England as under Charles II. Whenever you see his portrait, with his swarthy, ill-looking face and great nose, you may fancy him in his court at Whitehall, surrounded by some of the very worst vagabonds in the kingdom, though they were lords and ladies, drinking, gambling, indulging in vicious conversation, and committing every kind of profligate excess. It has been a fashion to call Charles II a the Merry Monarch. Atm. Let me try to give you a general idea of some of the merry things that were done, in the merry days when this merry gentleman sat upon his merry throne, in merry England. The first merry proceeding was of course to declare that he was one of the greatest, the wisest, and the noblest kings that ever shone, like the blessed sun itself, on this benighted earth. The next merry and pleasant piece of business was, for the Parliament, in the humblest manner, to give him £1,200,000 a year, and to settle upon him for life that old disputed tonnage and poundage which had been so bravely fought for. Then, General Monk being made Earl of Albemarle, and a few other royalists similarly rewarded, the law went to work to see what was to be done to those persons, they were called regicides, who had been concerned in making a martyr of the late king. 10 of these were merrily executed, that is to say, 6 of the judges, one of the council, Colonel Hacker and another officer who had commanded the guards, and Hugh Peters, a preacher who had preached against the martyr with all his heart. These executions were so extremely merry, that every horrible circumstance which Cromwell had abandoned was revived with appalling cruelty. The hearts of the sufferers were torn out of their living bodies, their bowels were burned before their faces, the executioner cut jokes to the next victim, as he rubbed his filthy hands together, that were reeking with the blood of the last, and the heads of the dead were drawn on sledges with the living to the place of suffering. Still, even so, merry a monarch could not force one of these dying men to say that he was sorry for what he had done. Nay, the most memorable thing said among them was, that if the thing were to do again they would do it. Sir Harry Vane, who had furnished the evidence against Strafford, and was one of the most staunch of the Republicans, was also tried, found guilty, and ordered for execution. When he came upon the scaffold on Tower Hill, after conducting his own defence with great power, his notes of what he had meant to say to the people were torn away from him, and the drums and trumpets were ordered to sound lustily and drown his voice, for, the people had been so much impressed by what the regicides had calmly said with their last breath, that it was the custom now, to have the drums and trumpets always under the scaffold, ready to strike up. Vane said no more than this. It is a bad cause which cannot bear the words of a dying man. ATM and bravely died. These merry scenes were succeeded by another, perhaps even merrier. On the anniversary of the late King ATM's death, the bodies of Oliver Cromwell, Ireton, and Bradshaw, were torn out of their graves in Westminster Abbey, dragged to Tyburn, hanged there on a gallows all day long, and then beheaded. Imagine the head of Oliver Cromwell set upon a pole to be stared at by a brutal crowd, not one of whom would have dared to look the living Oliver in the face for half a moment. Think, after you have read this reign, what England was under Oliver Cromwell who was torn out of his grave, and what it was under this merry monarch who sold it, like a merry Judas, over and over again. Of course, the remains of Oliver ATM's wife and daughter were not to be spared either, though they had been most excellent women. The base clergy of the time gave up their bodies, which had been buried in the abbey, and to the eternal disgrace of England they were thrown into a pit, together with the mouldering bones of Pym and of the brave and bold old Admiral Blake. The clergy acted this disgraceful part because they hoped to get the nonconformists, or dissenters, thoroughly put down in this reign, and to have but one prayer book and one service for all kinds of people, no matter what their private opinions were. This was pretty well, I think, for a Protestant church, which had displaced the Romish church because people had a right to their own opinions in religious matters. However, they carried it with a high hand, and a prayer book was agreed upon, in which the extremist opinions of Archbishop Laud were not forgotten. An act was passed, too, preventing any dissenter from holding any office under any corporation. So, the regular clergy in their triumph were soon as merry as the king. The army being by this time disbanded, and the king crowned, everything was to go on easily forevermore. I must say a word here about the King ATM's family. He had not been long upon the throne when his brother the Duke of Gloucester, and his sister the Princess of Orange, died within a few months of each other, of smallpox. His remaining sister, the Princess Henrietta, married the Duke of Orleans, the brother of Louis XIV, King of France. His brother James, Duke of York, was made High Admiral, and by became a Catholic. He was a gloomy, sullen, bilious sort of man, with a remarkable partiality for the ugliest women in the country. He married, under very discreditable circumstances, Anne Hyde, the daughter of Lord Clarendon, then the King ATM's principal minister and not at all a delicate minister either, but doing much of the dirty work of a very dirty palace. It became important now that the king himself should be married, and divers foreign monarchs, not very particular about the character of their son-in-law, proposed their daughters to him. The King of Portugal offered his daughter, Catherine of Braganza, and £50,000, in addition to which, the French king, who was favorable to that match, offered a loan of another £50,000. The King of Spain, on the other hand, offered anyone out of a dozen of princesses, and other hopes of gain. But the ready money carried the day, and Catherine came over in state to her merry marriage. The whole court was a great flaunting crowd of debauched men and shameless women, and Catherine Etienne's merry husband insulted and outraged her in every possible way, until she consented to receive those worthless creatures as her very good friends, and to degrade herself by their companionship.